always leave maybe two exits for the newcomers, but I think we've got enough to be going on with. Well, thanks, John. Thanks very much for everybody for coming again. Another really nice audience of friendly faces and some newcomers too. Glad we could all be here. This is the latest in the 60th anniversary seminar series organised by the Global Health Histories Initiative at WHO, which I look after, and the Wellcome Centre, the Wellcome Trust Centre for the History of Medicine in London, without whom we could not be doing this, and I continue to thank them very much for their support. And as usual, Sanjoy Bhattacharya is from the Wellcome Centre is here once again to help me pronounce the big words. I just want to briefly make a reference to one or two people who are here today, and notably my new-made colleague and friend, Professor Jim Webb, who's from the Department of History at Colby College, Maine, in the USA, where he's Director of African Studies, and is an expert in historical epidemiology and in the history of malaria, which is what I think brings you here now, and is working in the WHO archives on that. The Wellcome Centre is very well represented today. Apart from Sanjoy, we have our speaker, of course, who I'm going to ask to begin in a minute. And this is Dr. Sonu Chandasani. He's an expert on the history of psychology, psychiatry, and the human sciences in the second half of the 19th century and the first half of the 20th century. He's the author of many books, and I think, if I can make the remark, most notably an intellectual history of Carl Gustav Jung, called Jung and the Making of Modern Psychology. That the first volume of that work was published 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, and I believe you're deep into volume 2. Sonu is going to start in a moment, but before he does, I'm really, really delighted to introduce to you Professor Hal Cook, who's the director of the Wellcome Centre for the History of Medicine. And it's fantastic that you've come just for the day over half to show support. Hal is, I hope he will regard me as a friend. I feel he's a great friend of mine and a great supporter of WHO and this sort of work. Hal promotes the Wellcome Centre's work in promoting the history of medicine as making a fundamental contribution to the understanding of the human condition. In his own academic work, Hal continues to investigate subjects related to early modern English medicine, but his latest book in this globalized age reflects his more current work called Matters of Exchange, Commerce, Medicine and Science in the Dutch Golden Age. Hal, it's great to have you here. Would you honor us with a few words?
Thank you very much, Thompson. It is, let me just stand here. Merci. Forgive me. It's best if I speak English, I think. It's a great pleasure to be here. I know this has been a very successful series, and I'm very happy about that with the support of Wellcome Trust, but you know, for all of you here, as well as those of us who have come to visit. I just thought that I don't want to take much of your time, but one thing that people like me are often asked about is the lessons of history. And I just thought I would comment about that in the following way, that the lessons are plural, not singular. It's right that that's a plural word. And there are many, many lessons, and there are many different kinds of lessons. And so they're not obviously laws of nature either. They're the kind of lessons that's you, isn't it?
Yeah. Some other VIP arrived at the front desk.
Must have. No. Just that they're the kinds of lessons that, since they're not laws of nature, they, I think they're very helpful for clarifying our own positions in the world, both where we sit with relationship to other kinds of institutions and other kinds of groups of people and other parts of nature. They also help to clarify our thinking in terms of our position in the world, in terms of what we want to do in the world, and help clarify the arguments that we might want to make for doing what we think is really important. That can only come out from examples, and you'll get examples of one subject area in Sono's talk. But I think all of these examples are attempts on our part as historians to connect the general and the particular. That's something that everybody is doing here, I'm sure, in WHO, that when you have particular problems that you're dealing with, but also some very general problems within which those particulars are couched. And the question is how to connect really big issues with detailed studies. And that's what we historians are doing too, of course. And in thinking about historical examples, I think it can help us understand how people have connected the general and particular in their own lives in the past, from looking at these examples as well as some of the generalizations. But the examples count for a lot. And I think that can then, the most helpful way of history is to help us form our judgments from those examples. And so it doesn't give us guidance in terms of, as I said before, laws of nature that will tell us what to do next. But from the example of other people, we can learn a lot and understand the larger frameworks in which things are situated that can help guide our decisions and our judgments about what's to be done. I would just like to say one last thing, and that's in recent years, many of us at the center in London, as well as other historians around the world, have become very interested in the importance of knowledge exchanges in history, and how those have, for many, many centuries, of course, been the foundation of exchanges between people, between things that used to be called civilizations, between things that are now called cultures, between states, between all sorts of entities. It's knowledge exchanges that are one of the most important things for connecting people. I know that's really the business that you're in at WHO, the knowledge exchange. And I just want to say that I'm sure that one can see, looking back in history, how fundamental that is. The last thing to say is just one example. One can see, even in the 17th century, Dutch doctors being sent to Japan at the request of the Shogun, who wanted to know more about Western medicine and requested the Dutch East India Company, therefore, to send him an educated physician who knew chemistry and botany and the rest. Then asking questions about Western medicine, but that doctor in turn then got to know his Japanese colleagues on the other side, and from them, he in turn learned about acupuncture, and he was the first to publish a book in Europe in the 1670s, underwritten by the Royal Society of London, a book on acupuncture, and it created quite a lot of excitement for a short period of time. There's ups and downs in the history of acupuncture, but that's just one example that it didn't change the world, but it's one example of how these knowledge flows and knowledge connections, the exchange of knowledge, is important and has been there for a long time, and you come across it in strange ways all the time. But it's just to underline that in commerce and government and everything else, these exchanges of knowledge are what has made human life and what we might call, I know there's questions about the word these days, but what we might call progress, at least for material betterment, possible. So thanks for attending these seminars, and I'll turn it over to Sono.
Yes, thanks very much, Hal. I mean, Sono, without further ado, talk sticking out lengthy to have the best of the time. The floor is yours. Thanks.
Thank you.
Bonjour, c'est un très grand plaisir d'être ici. Je voudrais parler en anglais, mais vous pourriez poser vos questions en français ou en allemand ou des autres langues.
Yes, I understand.
Things haven't been going well.
Yes, Bonnie.
How could I be so wrong? My mate has been acting very strange. I can't explain it.
Yes.
I haven't been feeling very well myself.
Yes, I understand.
I don't know, maybe it's me.
Yes, fine.
I needed some Panora last night. I feel as if something...
Excellent.
...odd were happening to me. Something that...
Yes.
I can't understand.
Could you be more... specific?
The sedatives. I'm taking atrazine, but it doesn't seem strong enough. I have a hard time concentrating.
You are a true believer. Blessings of this day.
Please forgive me.
Blessings of the masses. Let us be thankful we have an occupation to fill. Work hard. Increase production. Prevent accidents. And be happy.
This is a clip from the first film by George Lucas, THX1138, where it presents a dystopian future where all citizens are obliged to enter psychotherapy booths and have their problems sorted out. Not, of course, that this is what I'm advocating or anyone here is advocating, but it's clear that the issue of mental health forms part of the definition of the constitution of the WHO. And indeed, at the following the Helsinki meeting in 2005, there was an action plan, as I'm sure you're all intimately familiar, drawn up concerning the issue of mental health in Europe by the European states. The statistics indicated there are quite alarming, namely that it's estimated that about 20% of the burden of health in European states is constituted or taken up by mental health. And furthermore, that out of 870 million residents, about 100 million are expected to encounter some form of anxiety or depression during some course of their life. And it's indicated that there's a glaring discrepancy between the budgetary levels of spent on mental health compared to other aspects of health. Declaration and Action Plan call for nothing less than a paradigm shift in mental health delivery across Europe. And amongst the vehicles for that was indicated the greater provision of psychotherapeutic services, seen as an effective treatment. Now this brings me to the topic today, namely what is psychotherapy. If one looks at the situation in Europe and America today, there is no consensus as to what psychotherapy is. There is a heterogeneous cluster of practices, societies, institutions, and contradictory legislation, not only just across Europe, but in other countries as well. So it's at this level that I think that history has a contribution to make in terms of addressing the context of precisely what is psychotherapy. If one is to envisage a further rollout or provision of psychotherapy, it behooves us to look at the question of What is this practice? What are the practices which use this name, and how did they come about? And it's significant to note that it's the term psychotherapy was only coined in 1872 by the English psychiatrist Daniel Hack Tuke. That's not Tuke. That is. In his work, Illustrations of the Effects upon the Mind of the Mind upon the Body, now Tuke proclaimed that physicians had long known the influence of the mind or imagination upon the body, but the time had come to turn this into a rational therapeutics, and this would distinguish these new practitioners from quacks. So at the beginning, one has a negative definition. What is a psychotherapist? A psychotherapist is not a quack, in this instance meaning a physician that cured without knowing how they cured. So the suggestion being, namely, that what was critical about the new science of psychotherapeutics was precisely that it was a science, to rationalize what was long known within the practice of medicine. Now, these transformations which occurred at the end of the 19th century were far-reaching in terms of both the practice of medicine and the generation of a new discipline or profession of psychotherapy. Now, as Charles Rosenberg notes, that by the last quarter of the 19th century, all medicine in some sense was necessarily psychosomatic, and every clinician had to be something of a psychiatrist and a family therapist. It was only within this last quarter that a seismic shift occurred. So at the end of the 19th century, concepts of disease specificity revolutionized medical practice and therapeutics. If specific pathogens could be seen as responsible for specific diseases, they could be universally treated by the same remedies, and there was no need for individualized patient care. So one has, as we all know, a somatic orientation gaining headway within medicine, particularly in the early 20th century, and the separation out of a separate profession of psychotherapeutics. Now, when Tuke was nominating a new profession or science of psychotherapeutics, he was referring back to developments going back about 100 years or more. So I'd like to basically just briefly consider the elements of what, at the end of the 19th century, became grouped together in a somewhat, dare I say, accidental and serendipitous manner under this new banner of psychotherapy. And I begin with the reconsideration of moral treatment. This is the retreat at York. And at the end of the 18th century, in 1796, William Tuke, a tea and coffee merchant and Quaker in York, set up a retreat specifically to care for Quakers who'd run into mental problems. It was not a medical institution. Later on, it became widened for non-Quakers as well. And Tuke held the view that mental disorders, mental diseases, originated in the mind. Therefore, he held that it was through administering to the mind that these would be best treated. His whole enterprise was based as a critique of the private and madhouses prevalent at this time. And he stressed revulsion from the inhumanity of treatments prevalent. Kindness and consideration for patients were to be the leitmotif of the York retreat. It was an atmosphere of religious sentiment and feeling, a space for recreation and employment. And so moral treatment was based on the premise that the insane were not seen as deprived of reason, but as children with an excess of force. They had a degree of intellectual moral powers which had not been obliterated but needed to be cultivated and reinstituted. Now, the aim of moral treatment for Tuke was to divert the mind from its preoccupations, employment through using sort of occupational therapy, recreations, outings, to as far as possible to re-socialize the patient as a rational being. Was to sort of reinstitute an internalized order of self-control within the patient, and quite clearly has an inspiration between practices within Quakerism at this time. So it's important to highlight that the whole practice of moral treatment at this stage in England was conceived of as a critique of medicine, which later led to reforms within treatments in silent care in the 19th century. But I switch to France, to Philippe Pinel. This scene here of Pinel liberating the insane at the Salpêtrière, of course, never happened. As Dora Weiner established, it was actually concierge Poussin who was responsible for this, and a legend later arose quite fallaciously. It was Poussin who, whilst working at the Bicêtre and at the Salpêtrière, advocated the notion that lunatics had previously been treated as ferocious beings, but that there were modes of repression which didn't harm individuals and had better effects. So that he removed the chains and replaced them with straight waistcoats, as they were called. The aim for Poussin, later advocated by Pinel, was to treat them with mildness, to win their confidence, to combat the objects which had affected them, and help them to envisage a happier future. So in 1801, Pinel wrote his classic text claiming that the English had not made their principles of treatment apparent, which is what he was attempting to do. Again, he stressed that it was important to divert the minds of patients from their hallucinations, to fix their interests on contrary influences and tendencies. Amongst the causes of madness, Pinel noted affectations of the mind such as thwarted ambitions, failed marriage prospects, religious fanaticism, and events connected with the revolution. In Pinel's notion, moral treatment consisted of countering passions with passions of equal force. So what is critical here is that he's starting with a conception of moral treatment which is leading to a new conception of mental disorder or alienation. It's as if the cure is part and parcel of the conception of what mental disorder consists of, i.e. disordered imagination, passions taken to the extreme, and one needs to almost undo this process by reinstituting different passions to shock the mind into regaining its equilibrium. As Pinel's student Esquirol, it's Esquirol, that's it. He's gone missing. So let me just find it. No, he's seriously gone missing. As Esquirol noted, that the importance was to treat the madman in such a way that he would realize that he was ill and hence would begin his cure. So what was needed was a moral shock to place the alienated in a contrary and opposed state. Now, this notion, as Marcel Gaucher and Gladys Swain have noted, led to sort of the new notion of an institution as a therapeutic institution, which aimed both to desocialize individuals, to relocate them within a new social order, with the aim of reintegrating them into society. This was the great dream of psychiatric asylum, and as the last nearly 200 years have shown, it basically didn't work. And we have here for the historian a nice sort of example of over a 200 year period of watching the rise and fall of an entire profession and discipline. But meanwhile, I'd like to switch to Austria. To Mesmer and his advocacy or invention of animal magnetism. Mesmer's work can best be sort of understood as a variety of popular Newtonianism. And in 1775, he claimed he discovered a new force of animal magnetism akin to universal gravity. Mesmer claimed that everyone was imbued with such a force, and that differences in its distribution led to illness, blockages in its distribution. Each individual could be conceived of as a magnet, and what was required was individuals who had a greater propensity of this force could reestablish this in others. So Mesmer's treatment took the form of establishing a rapport with the patient to regulate the magnetic fluid. This took the form of close physical contact and passes over the body. He then would then provoke a crisis which would bring out the latent disease. Now, many of the techniques described by Mesmer in his practices are still prevalent today in counterculture therapy. So it's the first thing to note about psychotherapy, in broadly put, or whatever one imagines this to be, that there are only a limited repertoire of things one person can do to another in the interests of cure. But how they become taken up becomes formulated differently in different contexts and with different social locations. So what Mesmer was promoting was a monistic medical physics, which explained both mental and physical disorders as being grounded in an invisible fluid, that of animal magnetism. This, of course, brought down the opprobrium of medical and scientific establishments, Lavoisier proclaiming that if Mesmer was right, basically all the medical schools would have to close and one would have to send everyone to study animal magnetism. So in 1784, two commissions were set up by the Faculté de Médecine and the Académie Royale des Sciences, and whose luminaries included Franklin and Lavoisier, and also Guillotin, who sort of did away with Lavoisier a few years later. Now, the commissioners investigated the practices of Deslon, who was a physician in Paris, who took up the practices of animal magnetism, and began to establish a set of experimental procedures, which have been in certain senses, the first rigorous attempt at a control trial within mental medicine, broadly put. Now, the commissioners did not doubt the veracity of the behavioral effects noted by Deslon and by Mesmer. What they were arguing was whether, as a counter-hypothesis, they could solely be ascribed to the influence of the imagination. Hence, if a known cause could account for the phenomena, there was no need to invoke a new force. And they put forward three factors which, in their view, sufficiently explain the effects of magnetism, namely, direct effect of physical manipulations, second, the powers of imagination, which had long been demonstrated by the history of medicine. But despite proclaiming the effects of the imagination, this was left simply as a negative term, namely, therefore, magnetism could be dismissed. However, the practice of magnetism spread outside of the medical establishment. Mesmer had established societies with the somewhat ironic term, the Society for Universal Harmony, which were nothing but harmonious. The practice became developed by the Marquis de Puységur, who had an experience with a Victor Reis, who had respiratory diseases, and when magnetized, had no convulsions, in contrast to Mesmer's treatment, went into a kind of sleep, a lucid sleep, of which he spoke and had no memory afterwards. In this state of somnambulism, Victor Reis obeyed Puységur's orders and was able to modify his ideas and sensations. Continuing this practice, he found that patients were able to diagnose their own diseases and prescribe their own treatments. The real agent for Puységur was not this mysterious magnetic neo-Newtonian fluid, but the magnetizer's own will. So we have here a situation that continues throughout the middle of the 19th century, of proponents of magnetism, some who adopt a fluidist theory following Mesmer, and others such as the Abbé Faria, who followed the you could say, more psychological view following Puységur. I switch now to the development of neurology, because at this point I've looked at the development of practices, first outside medicine within the York Retreat, within psychiatry in Paris with Pinel and moral treatment, and also outside of medicine again with the development and the rise of magnetic treatment. Come to George Miller Beard. Psychiatry, particularly in the US, developed as a private practice speciality following the Civil War, where there was a need to deal with nerve injuries and shell shock. Now, whilst the use of electricity in medicine goes back to the 18th century, it underwent a revival at the beginning of the 19th century through figures such as Duchenne. Demonstration of altered nerve properties under the influence of electricity provided a rationale for its therapeutic use. George Beard, who'd worked in an army hospital during the Civil War, in 1871 wrote a work with Alfonso Rockwell on the practical uses of electricity in medicine. They claimed that the use of electricity had the effect of, coining the word, a stimulating tonic. It almost sounds like an oxymoron, but it had both a stimulating and a tonic effect, and consequently it could be used for almost anything. If you wanted stimulation, it could work. If you wanted a tonic effect, it could work too. It could give relief from headaches, pain, neuralgia, general weariness, improve sleep, appetite, digestion, and lead to a feeling of enlivenment and increased capacity for work. And it was also valuable in cases of hysteria and depression. And furthermore, it had a beneficial effect on the practitioners themselves, as they often applied electricity through using their hands as an electrode, and this had a mild tonic effect on the doctors. So they used mild galvanic and ferritic currents, and would gently increase the current till patients felt a sensation of tingling, heat, and muscular contraction. In 1869, Beard coined the term neurasthenia to describe a state of nervous exhaustion primarily found, as in his view, in the United States and in the major cities. In Beard's view, factors of modern civilization, such as steam power, the telegraph, the periodical press, and the mental activity of women, had led to states of severe exhaustion. However, this was a demonstration of the superiority of American civilization. Much of the world's best work, Beard claimed, was done by neurasthenics. Using in a metaphorical way the notion of the conservation of energy, Beard claimed that each individual had a limited amount of nerve force, and that when they became run down, they needed to be topped up. And what better than to simply hook them up to a battery? So electrotherapy was the treatment of choice. Again, there was a gulf between the developing work in electrophysiology and the practical application of electrotherapy. The notion was somehow these two are related, but they could never demonstrate how. It's also clear here that development of electricity and electrotherapy precedes the nomination of neurasthenia. So it's in a way that fits an example of what Isabel Stengers calls disease mongering. It's the disease sort of, it follows the treatment and is designed to best respond to the treatment, namely electrotherapy. But electrotherapy then spread right throughout Europe and the US. But a problem also came in because of this disjunction between electrophysiology and practical application, because individuals simply went to the hardware store and picked up a battery and hooked themselves up. The notion was, why then did you need any specialized knowledge if you could just plug yourself in? Which led to a crisis in the electrotherapeutic movement. Another treatment that was promoted at this time for nervous exhaustion or neurasthenia was The Rescuer by Silas Weir Mitchell, which he stumbled upon the situation of individuals in the American Civil War undergoing cases of acute exhaustion, and that this being cured by rest and diet. In his work, Fat and Blood, he argued these states of exhaustion primarily afflicted women of a certain class, and what was required was rest, massage, electricity, and overfeeding. So treatments often required daily visits from the masseur, the doctor, and the electrician, as they were called. The daily menu consisted of milk, full-fat milk. I mean, they didn't go for skim milk in those days, administered every 2 hours. Patients had to go to bed for 6 weeks to 2 months and were under the care of a nurse and were prescribed no mental exertion, and they were forbid communication from home. So I don't know if overworked WHO workers here would sign up for a rest cure over the summer. And the notion of the rest cure, similarly to electrotherapy, was that it was a somatic treatment, but it was held that mental and emotional control would return with physical strength. So we have here somatic treatments being used to restore not only physical but also mental and emotional well-being. Now, return now to the developments in the magnetic treatment. This is James Braid, a Scottish physician, who in the 1850s began experimenting with animal magnetism and coined the word hypnosis. He argued that what was present in these practices of when you put an individual in a magnetic state was a diminished blood supply, which led to a state which he called monoideation, namely concentration of the mind upon one idea, and that this led to a state which he called a temporary human hibernation that had beneficial properties. A few decades later, the practice was also revived by Charles Richer, who later won the Nobel Prize for his work in physiology. Richer studied the state of provoked somnambulism and noted that patients would experience hallucinations, states of automatism, abolition of memory, and hyperideation. They would remember only what happened to them when they were replaced in the state, but after the state of somnambulism, they would be in a condition of amnesia. And he was able to suggest temporary personalities to them. The same faculty, he said, of playwrights, of entering and becoming imaginary figures. This was then taken up by Jean-Martin Charcot, famous neurologist. Though Charcot was not interested in the therapeutic applications of hypnosis, he claimed that hypnosis was a pathological state and was simply a symptom of hysteria. But what it did enable was one to look at the genesis of the formation of hysterical crises, namely the notion of traumatic shock, particularly in his work on male hysteria. The notion was individuals would undergo a state of shock which would not register in their mind, but would be like a hypnotic suggestion which later had effects on them and led to anesthesias and amnesias. Therapeutic application of hypnosis was taken up by Hippolyte Bernheim, who wrote a work on this in 1884. And the term that Bernheim used as his key explanatory term was that of suggestion. The notion that Bernheim used as a sort of paradigm was that ideas are received in the brain before they're subject to criticism. Thus, if I say, there is a spider on the wall behind you, you'd be inclined, according to Bernheim, to agree with me before turning to look to subject it to criticism. So the mind works by suggestion, by ideomotor reflex action. So this was the basic tendency of turning ideas into acts. The difference between the state of sleep or nervous sleep and the state of hypnosis for Bernheim was simply that an individual in a state of hypnotic sleep, as it were, fell asleep, but with his thoughts fixed and in relation with another individual. Hence the possibility of a doctor suggesting dreams, ideas, and acts by this foreign will. The implications according to Bernheim, for a suggestion for medicine was quite specific. And he argued that much that had occurred within the history of medicine hitherto had actually been the unwitting application of practice of suggestion. He raised the question of how many specific medications there actually were in medicine at this time. The bulk of medicine, in his view of pharmacopoeia, was simply consists of symptomatic medicine. The illness itself escaped us, and we simply tried to deal with its functional elements. And it was here, he argued, that suggestion often worked when medications failed. So many practices, such as electrotherapy or magnetotherapy, the application of magnets, were simply the embodiment of suggestion within a material form. And Bernheim also began experimenting with placebos, simply giving individuals inert pills, and found them to be just as effective. Now, the next major figure in this is I'd like to deal with is Pierre Janet, Charcot's star pupil at the Salpêtrière, and what Janet focused on was the state of what he called dissociation. Now, the type of experiments that he would use to explain this or to demonstrate this is if you have an individual and you read them a particular work and someone else says something to them and interrupts them, the mind splits into two trains of thought. And he argued that in certain cases this could go so much to the extent of setting up two chains of memory or two alternate personalities. The importance of hypnosis and psychotherapy for Janet was to attempt to retrieve traumatic memories, to restore the lost chains of connection. Now, so by the end of the century, it was in 1892 that Bernheim adopted the word psychotherapy to describe his practice, adopting the term from Hack Tube. And first, it was simply used as a synonym for hypnotic and magnetic treatment. So there was no need for, it was not as if people said, let's, apart from Tube, let's set up a new discipline of psychotherapy. It was like a 20-year hiatus before the term re-entered the popular domain. And here applied simply to the practice of hypnotic suggestion. In 1897, German physician Leopold Löwenfeld wrote a textbook of general psychotherapy. And he attempted to say that it was wrong to view psychotherapy as simply linked to hypnotic suggestion. And indeed, he argued by contrast that psychotherapy is no achievement of the modern age. If we look in history towards the first beginnings of our art, it's a clear and unmistakable fact that amongst the different methods of healing which were used, psychotherapy is the oldest, and it represents the first and original form in which the practical art of healing was exercised. So here's Löwenfeld saying that psychotherapy is nothing other than medicine itself. And he differentiated the history of psychotherapy into religious therapy, Greco-Roman psychic therapy in medicine, rational and profane psychotherapy since the Middle Ages, and finally the era of hypnosis and suggestion. So one here has a situation that suddenly within the space of a few years, psychotherapy is not only being used to refer to suggestion, but it's also now being imported back, and individuals are claiming, in fact, that all of medicine consists of psychotherapy. And this is at the same time when there's a whole shift away from what Edward Schwartz would later call the informal psychotherapy of the medical consultation with disease specificity. Now, so what is going on here? The term is being variously applied to practices as diverse as mesmerism, hypnotism, suggestive therapy, moral treatment going back to Pinel and Esquirol, and then being revived by Paul Dubois up nearby in Berne and Jules Desjardins in Paris, to mind cure in the United States, to mental healing, to strengthening of the will, to re-education, to the cathartic method of Freud and Breuer, to rational persuasion, and indeed to general practice of medicine or the art of medicine itself. It's completely amorphous, but at the same time, institutions are being set up, societies are being set up, conferences are being arranged. But the question floats in the sense there's no clear consensus as to what that the practice consists of. And in my view, this really pre-stages the situation we have today. The two additional elements I'd like to sort of mention is, first is the significance of psychoanalysis, which in my view has been overplayed in the sense of what is critical about psychoanalysis within this broader framework of the development of psychotherapy is quite simply it institutionalized psychotherapy in the sense that Freud began practice as an electrotherapist and a hypnotist, and his practices and procedures really form part and parcel of this general sort of hypno-moral, therapeutic, electro-suggestive, cathartic, educational scene. But what is critical was the establishment of specific institutions outside of the medical school and the university, specifically through the inauguration of a notion of training analysis, the notion that individuals who wanted to become practitioners had to undergo experience as a patient. And it was this, in my view, that led to the survival of psychoanalysis, i.e. it created its own population. And this was its main sort of inaugurative innovation. And again, to pass rapidly onto the situation of Jung, in my view, significance of Jung within this framework was shifting psychotherapy from purely a practice to deal with pathology or neurosis towards what I'd call higher development of the healthy. The notion is, well, do the healthy need a higher development? Jung said yes, because Western Europe and America suffered from a context of a loss of meaning due to the collapse of organized religion. The cure for Jung took the form of higher development of a non-denominational kind through psychotherapy. And again, this has become one of the hallmarks or one of the main modalities of psychotherapy in the 20th century. But before concluding, I'd like to just sort of move a little bit further forward in terms of the situation in the mid-20th century onwards. We have here a notion, as indicating, of a cluster of various therapeutic practices, and at the same time, that a shift of medicine and practice of medicine in quite another direction. Questions of mental influence re-enter medicine with developments of randomized clinical trials and the formulation of the concept of the placebo effect. The term itself was formulated in 1955 by Henry Knowles Beecher, an American physician at Massachusetts General Hospital, Harvard Medical School, in a paper in the American Medical Journal, Journal of the American Medical Association, called The Powerful Placebo. Now, what Beecher did in this article was, using the new developed tools of meta-analysis in statistics, he studied a number of works in the last 10-15 years ago, which had begun researching the notion of placebos. Now, he argued that the relative constancy of the placebo in these studies indicated that there was a fundamental mechanism was operative. So initially formulated within these placebo studies in the 1940s as simply a source of experimental error within experimentation. Through Beecher, the term became elevated to a universal psychophysiological principle mechanism with powerful psychomimetic effects, and a whole tradition of research over the last few decades has been attempting to identify the precise physiological mechanisms of the placebo effect. Now, this led to an explosion of interest in the placebo, and whilst Beecher and others initially argued that the use of placebos could enable the effects of drugs to be distinguished from that of suggestion, the term suggestion, prevalent from the psychotherapeutic literature I've mentioned, soon became replaced by that of the placebo effect, which also signals a disciplinary separation of medicine and the study of mental factors in medicine from psychology and psychiatry. In 1962, Louis Lasagna simply noted, in medicine, the effect of the placebo of suggestion is referred to as the placebo effect. Now, through this, a semantic expansion of the concept of the placebo took place. It now encompassed such factors as natural history of disease, routine medical and nursing care, the art of medicine, and inert pills. So we have here a notion that everything that is not the effect of a pill is put in this box called the placebo. Everything that the psychologists are claiming is their domain of psychotherapeutics, of suggestion, is this negative, which it's held could simply be subtracted as the methodologically eliminated as a monolithic factor from clinical trials. So through this, the notion of the modern experimental subject arose, namely a subject whose responses to treatment could be neatly subdivided into two headings. One, the direct causal effects of drugs, and two, as a result of the placebo effect on the other. So this relegated the whole area of psychology and suggestion and of psychotherapeutics within medicine. Yet at the same time, one has this bifurcation of the study of mental influence still going on within the psychotherapeutic profession. So to conclude, I began by indicating the context of the significance of the topic of mental health within contemporary deliberations in the WHO, which I'm sure you're far more informed of than I am, and the mode in which, in my view, a consideration of the history of psychotherapy is quite significant to sort of say, if one is planning to, as it were, roll out or advocate psychotherapeutics practices, it behooves one to look at, well, precisely what are these practices? How have they come about? What is their relation to medicine? As I've indicated, really within a quite short time span of 125 years, when it's had quite vast shifts of disciplinary location of psychotherapy and medicine and the place of how mental factors should be viewed and used, manipulated for therapeutic purposes and also used in the establishment of clinical trials. So I thank you for your attention.
Thanks very much. Sorry some of you have to leave. I know that the time is running out for you, but there is time for some questions and discussion. And Sonia, I'm sure, will be glad to take your questions. Don't be shy. Don't be inhibited, let me know who would like to ask the first one. I know there's a few bubbling under the surface there, so who would like to start? Yes, ma'am. Ruth, isn't it?
That's true. It's a large question. It'd be a separate talk unto itself. Salpêtrière was initially at that point a hospital for old women, so that's why in that case the chains are being loosed from a woman. In terms of the issue of gender within psychotherapy, the question is where to begin. So it's quite clear that most of the figures of I showed were men with or without beards, but that there are no women that are actively involved or until the early 20th century. But in terms of there are discussions at each level within these different practices. So for instance, the Commission of Animal on Animal Magnetism in 1784 highlighted the fact that there was a secret report by Bally noting that most of the treatments are done in women, and basically if you look at what is going on, this looks highly eroticized, to put it mildly, but this shouldn't be made public because it's a danger to the morals.
is another issue of the program of the treatment. But I mean, there's an awful lot there. It depends almost like which decade you want to look at. Well, actually, precisely because of my argument, I can't encapsulate it, precisely because I'm saying that it's a heterogeneous development. There's not like one story of the rise of psychotherapy or one psychotherapy. You've got different practices within neurology, psychiatry, hypnotism, and outside, each of which have got different cultural and social modalities. So there's no, you can't tell one story about that and consequently not about, about gender.
And the next one.
Kind of a follow-on question then. You were mentioning that the problem of what was once called shell shock, and might have different names for it today, provoked some new thoughts about the way to intervene therapeutically. I wonder if there's a tradition within nursing and caring for war wounded that developed the idea of compassion as a therapeutic intervention. One thinks that very many of the caregivers to individuals who were caught up in wars and damaged by them were women. Is there such a discourse outside of psychiatry or outside of the psychoanalytical tradition, but that deals with psychotherapeutic compassion in the nursing
tradition? It's an important question. I think that what that to me highlights is the significance of the fact that, as some people are indicating, they're not elaborating, that a lot of these procedures which are now then called psychotherapy a part and parcel of general medical practice or medical care. So that you simply have the attempt to simply highlight and nominate certain aspects of medical procedure. And in my view, it actually comes about precisely paradoxically through the increasing somaticism within the 1870s and 1880s. That there's the need to separate out another element and to call it something else. But that in that sense, the history of nursing is quite important too. And it's hard to track because these are not factors which are then, people aren't writing essays or this is not even featuring terribly much within medical textbooks because it's taken for granted.
So, just one question, if you then try to look forward into the future of psychotherapy, and if you look at the history and what you mentioned about the randomized controlled trials versus the placebo effect, and that in effect it was up to the psychotherapist to compete on the placebo effect. And if you look at Popper's critique of Freud, for example, and that a lot of this is philosophy in it, hypothesis that can't be rejected.
Mm.
And if you think about how psychotherapy will develop in the future,
well, I hope it won't develop along the lines of George Lucas's film at the beginning, sort of rather dystopian sort of vision of that. I mean, in terms of the placebo, psychologists and the experimental social psychologists simply lost in the sense they were attempting to say, look, we're actually dealing with this. This is our domain, and that was work done in the 50s and 60s. It's just got pushed to one side. The question there is, just to add a further element of it, which is the context of psychiatry. You have here today in many countries a situation where psychiatry is in a state of crisis because there is no need for psychiatric expertise. serotonin inhibitors, antipsychotics, even generally prescribed by GPs. So often the first port of call of individuals with emotional, existential, mental difficulties is a GP, and they get prescribed the full range of what a psychiatrist offers. So you have somatic treatments being given out in 5-minute consultations, and there's no room there for psychotherapy either. So you've got a context where quite clearly there is a nomination of mental factors, but they're largely being dealt with not only somatically but somatically by general practitioners without any specific professional expertise dealing with that. Now, I think the consequences of that are huge for both psychiatry and psychotherapy, because they really don't have much place left to go. But that's not to say that, again, looking from across, say, 100 years of different forms of therapeutic treatments, they're all forms of, all modalities of therapeutic conversations, which change and transform and have different social locations. So no doubt that different networks or complexes of practices and institutions will emerge.
Thank you. Another question?
Recently I saw on TV the opera Così fan tutte, and I was surprised to see that some of the characters were making fun of Mes principles, which mean that even in those days there were heated debates and a lot of irony about this development. So how did that, let's say, bring some additional color to the debate?
Absolutely. You find that at every epoch, both high culture and also the newspaper discussion of what is the status of these new, supposedly new treatments, what is actually going on, and a notion that a contestation of the claims of new knowledge and of the efficacy of treatments. And this goes right as a leitmotif right throughout the history of psychotherapeutics.
And to continue a former question, there is now a certain temptation of neurosciences to reduce all, science of the psyche to purely biological signals. So how do you feel about this trend?
Well, to take up the previous question, if someone is able to market a form of psychotherapy with a supposed legitimation of neuroscience, just in the same way as electrotherapy was claiming a legitimation of electrophysiology, I'm sure it would be vastly successful. But the issue in terms of, I mean, I'm not a historian of neuroscience, so I like to sort of stop when my subjects are well and truly dead, and so I don't have to deal with living individuals. But it seems to me that the problematic at a contemporary level, so speaking not historically, is that if you're attempting to reduce something to a neurophysiological basis, you have to know what it is that you're reducing. Namely, you have to know what it is that you're reducing. So if you take the notion, say, let's say emotion, then the question is, if you're trying to look at precise localization, you have to decide what an emotion is. But if there's no consensus at a level of pure phenomenology of what an emotion is, what love is, what hate is, it becomes quite difficult to move beyond correlation, which is easy to establish, but to sort of a causative hierarchical model becomes, to my mind, completely impossible. So, of course, one has developments in neuroimaging that are quite fantastic, but that there's a huge gap in any attempt to reduce complex behaviors to that level.
And by the way, there was this very week at Palexpo, the European Conference on Neuroscience, so I don't know if anyone in this room did attend or interact in any way and would have something to say on
this. I don't know, was anyone there at that particular meeting?
Was WHO involved in any sense?
I'm not aware. I must confess I don't know very much personally about the work of the Department of Mental Health at WHO. I wonder, Santina, is it possible for you to say a word or two about the current work of the department here for the general benefit of the audience? I don't mean to push you too much on that, but...
I don't know whether it benefit the audience, but I have enjoyed the lecture. And it will be very interesting. At this time, what we are involved in WHO from the department is to look at the evidence-based interventions, which include not only medicines, but also psychotherapeutic interventions. And at least some of them have shown very clear evidence for effects on clear disorders. I'm not meaning psychological problems, but very clearly the disorders and cognitive behavioral psychotherapy, also some psychosocial rehabilitation techniques have very clear evidence-based effect. And we are putting them in the essential package for management of mental disorders all across the world. Our big problem is, as you also pointed out, resources allocated for mental health care are so tiny that anything which requires time and effort and skilled people is very difficult to be scaled up in terms of numbers. So of course medicines are much easier to give, although there are issues about whether it should be done or not. And psychotherapeutic interventions, even if effective, are very difficult to be administered in large numbers. That remains a big problem. And that brings me back to another issue that I want to ask you about. Is there a kind of social class division over the historical trend about people who would receive psychotherapy versus people who would not? Was it a treatment for the elite always?
Not always. I would say that some of the developments, so if we, Mesmer's treatments were for an elite, they were fee-paying, but then Puseker treated people for free. Bernheim was working in a general hospital in Nancy, and again, this was not a fee-paying context. Or Liebo, who Bernheim saw as his master, French country doctor who treated for free. Their attempt to develop psychotherapeutic clinics at this stage, some of them were fee-paying, some of them were not. And attempts within, say, to develop therapeutic treatments within psychiatry, which were not for elites, but were quite broad, demotically based. So, yes, on the one hand, the emphasis has been on private practice, which has been elites who are fee-paying private medicine, but that there have been significant initiatives within hospital settings and otherwise. I wanted to ask, do you have some sense of any explanation for the lack of resources that are allocated to mental health issues?
No. We wrote an article in The Lancet in September last year, which is about resources. to embrace and the reasons for that. It's difficult to say. One is that psychiatry as a medical discipline is somewhat younger as an integrated discipline. Of course, psychiatry has a long history, but as a part of medicine, it is somewhat younger. And also that the stigma and discrimination that we see against patients perhaps also comes across against disciplines. And so public policy making is always keeping mental health and mental disorders at a very low level of life. And one has to really analyze the reasons much more. But that has been the pattern historically and has continued without substantial improvement.
I wonder if I could introduce and maybe tease a question out of another distinguished visitor today. Professor Vincent Barras from Lausanne University's Institute on the History of Medicine and Public Health. I was looking at your website this morning. I don't mean to embarrass you by suddenly saying, come up with a question instantly. But I was looking at your website, which is linked to our website, by the way. And apart from discovering that you've got 26,000 books in your library, how many of them have you taken? The oldest going back to the 16th century. I found that the Institute's areas of interest include the history of psychiatry and neurosciences. And I just wonder whether there's any connections that you care to make at all with this.
We have a stupid connection. Working on similar topics. You didn't mention this question of commentary, maybe.
Good, thank you for being
here. We work together on topics like you mentioned several times in your talk that psychoanalysis is like a tree that hears the root, l'arbre qui cache la forêt, as we say. And I think this is particularly provocating today because for me, one very good point of all the works, I mean, you know that, but I tell you this for the audience, that we tend to see one cultural figure as the whole figure of everything that covers all of psychotherapy, okay, in the name of psychoanalysis, but it's very important, I think, to work historically, just to discover that, and just make other things being discovered, like that tend to show that psychoanalysis is only one trend in the whole big trend of psychotherapy, which also pervades somatic points, which I find particularly interesting. And there are also figures here in Geneva, local figures like Theodore Flournoy, which we both like very much, who was a contemporary of Freud and Jung that you didn't mention. So maybe you could add some point about the sort of importance of the formal in this respect.
Well, yeah. Thanks. Just to take up your point, to sort of stress the point in my view, the electrotherapeutic movement had more of a significance in the development of psychotherapy than psychoanalysis, because that was one of the main things that created the space, the social space for private practice neurology as a form of treatment of mental and emotional conditions. So again, that's why Freud starts with reading Wilhelm Erb and taking up buying his batteries and his electrical gear. And the sense is that there is a common misconception that Freud is the founder of psychotherapy, but that speakers such as Bernheim have had far more significance and an influence in that sense of creating space and possibility for a psychotherapeutic movement. Now, concerning Flournoy, who's really the most significant psychologist in Geneva around the turn of the century, and in many respects it's incentive. It's interesting in this regard that he doesn't actually dabble or get terribly interested in psychotherapeutics and remains more orientated to exploring similar conditions of hypnosis, somnambulism, trance, dreams, religious experience, but from a purely psychological angle. Now, of course, these things aren't distinct because the main attempt at the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th, was the notion that psychotherapy could be a new science through linking it with a new psychology, and that this would henceforth also transform all aspects of Western societies. So that I see Flournoy as slightly more tangential in this regard.
Thank you. Carol?
For those of us who are sort of lay people with regard to psychotherapy, Freud is the name that has become an icon. But does he deserve that reputation? Did he really contribute that much? What was his real status in your view?
Well, I think, as I say, in terms of psychotherapy, it was more institutional in setting up the training apparatus, which then became taken up and duplicated by other forms of psychotherapy, separated from psychoanalysis. But so I think what happened through a process, I think, of quite deliberate cultivation of a legend and tendentious rescripting of history, psychoanalysis came to stand in a metonymic manner for this whole mishmash of new psychologies, new therapeutic practices. And I've written about that, or attempted to write about that, in a book I published about 2 years ago with Mikael Borg Jacobson entitled Le Dossier Freud. So that's our main argument there, that it's a process of tendentious historical rescripting, starting with Freud and his followers. Now, that's not to say that psychoanalysis didn't have significances or wasn't doing interesting things, but you need to sort of peel off the legend before you can sort of resituate it within its context.
It was a good question, Carol. I like that one. I wish I had that. I think we maybe have just time for one more, and then we may have to draw to a close. Is there a last point?
Maybe to end on a provocative tone.
Oh, that's always a good idea,
and,
yes.
And in a way, it would be an add-on to the follow-up question. Someone asked whether psychoanalysis and former psychotherapeutic treatment were for the elite.
Yeah.
In the 20th century, there had been a kind of disorder which was very democratically distributed. It is a sexual disorder. And the psychoanalyst was, 30 years ago, the only resources, if any, of, for instance, for sexual importance. And today, one pill of Viagra is worth more than the complete works of Freud for at least this category of people. Mm. So one should also take that.
Right, okay, yeah.
Yeah, that's that.
That's
the,
hard.
The attempt of psychotherapeutic practices to deal with conditions such as, you say, sexual disorders or sexual behaviors, class disorders or enuresis or other physical conditions or even insomnia, is an interesting history into itself, an attempt of psychological means to, as it were, encroach upon somatic conditions and to read them in purely psychological ways. And as you indicate, in many respects, it didn't really, it's something that's more or less collapsed. But there was a lot of work done for many decades along those lines.
Thank you. Anyone else? Yes.
One last.
All
question.
Right, Jim. I could see there was just something.
I have one
there.
Last question. I'd like to put to the gentleman down there in mental health. We're talking about psychotherapies and psychological problems as largely being individual matters, but it strikes me that war trauma and all of the psychological sequelae from war are probably the major problem that we've got globally. And I'm wondering if war trauma comes into the thinking of the Department of Mental Health here, and is that part of what you all think about? Are there any protocols for the treatment of people who have had their lives torn up by warfare?
The answer is a clear yes. The mental health and psychosocial aspects of emergencies and disasters, not only natural disasters, but also the conflict, war situations, is very much on our portfolio. In fact, if you like, you pick up a copy of what are called the IASC guidelines for psychosocial and mental health care, which are not WHO, but the whole UN system. It's a UN-wide system guidelines, which we have developed along with others.
Mm-hmm.
And this provides a very good framework for what could be done.
Mm-hmm.
It has hardly any psychotherapy, so don't look for that. But it has a set of principles and strategies which have been found to be quite effective for taking care of people who have suffered because of these problems, not only directly but also indirectly, in terms of families, communities, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we are very much involved with that.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks very much. I'd like to thank again, Sunil. You gave us a terrific talk. Thank you very much for coming. Nice to see you here. Again, thanks, Hal and Sanjoy, Welcome Centre, for being so nice and putting these seminars before such an interested audience, and an interesting audience as well. I think your questions and your participation in this is always very rewarding. So thanks again for coming, and to our speaker. And a thanks from me to all of you. Thank you very much.